Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. We are talking today to United States Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Brandy. He's a Vietnam War veteran. He's author of the book, The Warrior's Guide to Insanity, and he is a combat trauma consultant with the Department of Defense. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary. It's an honor and a privilege to be here to talk on behalf of our young veterans.
And psychotherapist Ellen Fox joins us. She's the convener of the Santa Fe Soldiers Project. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
And Rick Iannucci, who is the director of the Horses for Heroes program. He's a former Green Beret and a retired U.S. Marshal. Great to have you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be here.
So, Sergeant Brandy, we have a situation facing our veterans today in the United States, which a lot of people have no idea about.
Oh, that is correct. I think the first thing that I would like to say to the listening audience, for those mothers, fathers, spouses, children of veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq, I want you to understand that your loved ones are absolutely normal for what they've been through. And this nation now faces a crisis we have never faced before. We have more troops that have seen so much combat now that far exceeds the combat in Vietnam, World War II, Korea. In fact, combined. I've been asked many times, why is it that our troops are having such a difficult time with reintegration, with adjustment, with coming back into civilian life? Well, it's not too hard to figure when you think about the statistics. In World War II, the average combatant saw approximately 140 days of combat. In Vietnam, we saw approximately 240 days of combat per tour. When I was speaking to 3,800 troops at Fort Polk, Louisiana, those young men and women from the 10th Mountain were back home after four 15-month tours. That's over 1,800 days of combat. They are now redeployed in Afghanistan. I know troops that are on their fifth and sixth deployments. That's 5-6 years of combat. 10 times, 11, 12 times more than World War II, 6-7 times more than Vietnam. So when you go through that kind of sustained trauma, when your life is threatened every day, when you watch your friends blown apart, burned alive in Humvees, blown up in IEDs, it scars your brain. It sets permanent memories in place that you never, ever get rid of, but you can learn to deal with them. And that's part of what Ellen and Rick are doing with their programs. But we have to have the tools in place to do that. Many of the troops are not getting enough help. There's no decompression when they come back. And if you'd like, I can tell you a story. A young soldier told me last year, 26-year-old sergeant. He came, first of all, he was on patrol in Iraq, a five-man team, going through a village and saw some movement in a doorway. An AK-47 rifle muzzle came out. He fired at that object, killed a man. The man fell out of the doorway onto the pavement. Immediately, a woman came out of the same doorway. She picks up the AK-47, starts to turn it on his fire team. He shot her. And then a small girl, about 10 years old, dressed in white, came out of the doorway, grabbed the rifle. He screamed no, and she didn't listen. She picked up the rifle and started to move it up toward his fire team. As it was firing, he had to kill her. And then, of course, in white, the memory of that child covered in blood. Well, he got home to the Denver airport 18 hours after this killing. He walked in. His wife and his daughter were waving flags. He told me, "Sarge, tears started to run down my face." He said, "It wasn't because I was glad to see my wife and child. It was because I had just killed a woman and a child that looked exactly like my family." He was shaking so hard, his daughter asked him, "What's wrong, Daddy?" And he said, "Oh, I'm okay, honey." He went to kiss his wife, and he couldn't even hold his child or kiss his wife. Now, that relationship has ended in divorce. There is a restraining order against him to see his child. He is redeployed. And this is very, very typical of what's happening to our troops.
You tell stories out of your own life that are in your book. I mean, I was starting to read your book, and you said, I'm going to start slow
right.
so that people don't have to deal with the heavy stuff at the beginning of the book. And you launch straight into the heaviest stuff there is
well.
That it's possible to even do, which is what it was like for you to be a soldier and the first time you killed people.
Right. And we remember now, at that time, I was 18 years old. The average combatant now is 18 to 25. Still the same. I mean, Ellen can talk about the brain development. Their brains aren't even developed. I was a child with a rifle with a license to kill. And I think it's important for the public to understand that these are trained killers. You have to be to win battles. But when they come back home, nobody's explaining how to get that primal side, that beast side of them, under control. And there is a subculture now. At Fort Carson, I know the clinicians there very well. For those troops that have killed children, it is especially difficult.
Well, that was your first experience.
That was my first experience, right.
And you didn't know what was happening. You didn't know what you were doing.
No.
And as you say, you were never the same person again. And I think when people talk about healing trauma, it's important to remember you can never go back.
That's exactly correct. The word trauma means to wound or pierce the soul. And once you have lost the closest friend you've ever had in this world, once you have killed another human being, which violates our mandate for survival of the species, it's not that it's so difficult to kill, it's the consequences of the kill. Some psychiatrists call it a moral dissonance. Our moral upbringing is dictating to us what we feel is normal and right, and yet we've violated that by taking the life of one of our own species, especially children. And that never goes away. You always have the scars, but through the proper therapy, through the proper help, we can learn to deal with that and keep that primal side under control. Do you know what I mean by that primal side? It's what's brought out in boot camp, it's what's nurtured, and it's what we have to do in war. If we're going to win wars, we have to become war. And there's no protocol, there is no Geneva Convention, none of these rules of engagement. It's kill or be killed. And our troops are doing a wonderful job at winning battles, but it's taking a toll on their souls, on their spirit, on their bodies, on their minds.
The process of it you describe in your book in a very hardcore way, a little bit difficult reading for people who've never been through it. For people who have been through it, you are clearly a soul brother to anybody who's been through combat, because the language and the rawness of the description that you have must be familiar to anybody who's been through that.
It is. A lot of troops tell me it's like you're inside of me when I'm speaking to them, because I know exactly what they're feeling. You almost have to go through it to understand it completely. So there's no way around it.
Now, one of the things that happens is the first time, as you describe in this book, that you have this experience of killing innocent people, killing children, it's harrowing. Then you get used to it and you become numb.
That's correct.
Then you come back and you think you're fine and you're not.
That's correct. Let me be very graphic, but not too harsh here. When you kill another human being for the first time, something changes inside of you. Absolutely changes, especially children. Then after a while, you become numb more and more and more. And pretty soon, you lose your touch with your own humanity, let alone with the humanity around you. Nothing is of value. Not animals, not people. They all become the enemy. And what do you do with the enemy? You kill the enemy. Now, here's a startling thing for some people to understand. After a while, you begin to like it. You really like it. It's a rush to kill human beings in battle that are trying to kill you. And it becomes almost like an opiate. The adrenaline rush that you get in combat is like nothing else that's ever going to happen to you. And when a lot of these troops come back, they jump on the crotch rockets, they do skydiving, they do rappelling, they do all the things to try to get that adrenaline back, and they can't. If they're on the edge to the point where they feel self-destructive, suicidal, or homicidal, want to go out and kill other people, then that's when suicide by police occurs. They want that last firefight, that last adrenaline rush to get it back one more time, to give them some self-worth, some self-esteem, and to make them feel alive.
And that certainly goes a long way toward explaining a lot of the manifestations, violent manifestations on the part of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder veterans.
That's exactly right. A lot of that has to do with reliving the moment. The flashbacks that they have are going back to a time when they had some self-esteem, some power. You know, they were the judge, jury, and executioner all enrolled in one. And man, that felt great. I know it did. I did it. And then they come back here and they can't even get a job at Jiffy Lube. They've lost their families. They've lost their children because they have restraining orders against them in many, many cases. They feel like they've lost their whole life. And yet they fought. They gave up their lives to defend the things that they believed in and this country. And they feel betrayed. And they feel angry. And they want payback. And they're getting very little help.
One of the things that characterizes the current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan is that there's not even that clarity about defending something that you believe in. There's a lot of cynicism about why they're there in the first place among the soldiers.
Well, I can explain this to you very clearly. They are not there against terrorism, many of them, most of them that I've talked to. They're there because their brothers and their sisters are there. They're not fighting for any cause except to preserve the life of the people they love the most in the world. And the warrior trust bond between these troops is so intense. The friendship that they've established between their fellow warriors is so intense. It goes beyond the love of country, the love of family, of children, of God, of everything. It is strong to the point where they would give up their life in a second. And let me give you an example. Think about someone you love, or perhaps your best friend in the world. Then ask yourself, would that friend give up their life for me right this second, without hesitation? That is what warriors do every day. We die for each other. And there's a bond that occurs when that happens that is indescribable. There's no way I can express it in words. But that's the bond that they go back to. I've talked to so many troops that all they want to do is go back and kill Haji. All they want to do is go back and die in a righteous firefight. They don't use that's an old word, righteous, but a really good firefight and die with honor, protecting their friends and killing the enemy. They have been so desensitized. They have experienced so much war that they don't have any future vision, no vision. All their vision is of dying. And now here's another element that most people don't realize. If I say to you, suicide, does that make a little fear, a little, maybe a little discomfort in you? For most people, it does. When you say that to a warrior, we face death every single day in battle. My life expectancy in Vietnam was 3.5 seconds in a firefight. After you make it through 5 or 10 firefights, after you make it through one tour, you think you've made it. Now imagine having made it through 150 firefights, then going back for a second tour, and a third tour, and a fourth and fifth tour. Our troops are facing something that most civilians never deal with, the reality of death. They have consigned themselves to that, they have resigned themselves to that inevitable fate and expect it. So then if you're going to die, why not do it right? Why not go out in a blaze of glory, protecting the people you love more than anything in the world? And that's their focus. They don't expect to live. How could you, after 5 tours in combat? So, you see, there's a whole other perspective here that most civilians don't see.
And then you come back. You didn't go in like that. You
No.
were a normal kid. You were an 18-year-old who'd gone to high school and
Sure.
dated girls and played basketball or whatever.
Right.
And then you become this, and then you can't go back No. to anything like your old self.
Well, I can explain it like this. When I talk to the troops, I talk about them being baptized in blood. And they are baptized in the blood of battle. It's not the blood of their enemies. It's the blood of their friends. When that happens, the innocence of youth is gone forever. And they live then in two worlds. The one world is the warrior world of honor, of discipline, of respect. And the other world is a civilian world, a gray world. Well, honor is difficult to find for a lot of troops here. And they're caught between these two worlds, two realities, like they've crossed the River Styx, and now their boots are firmly planted in two worlds. And those two worlds do not mesh. Those are two separate realities, dimensions of time, of existence. And that's a conflict. Back and forth, moment to moment, day to day, between these two worlds.
What did you do when you came back from Vietnam?
I was drunk most of the time. I had no help for 10 years. Alcohol was my... Now, I know they call it self-medicating. I just wanted to kill the pain any way I could. Being a Marine, I ran myself, dropping, getting up, running till I drop again, drinking till I was passed out to cut the pain. Now, that is not the way to do it. You don't have to do that now. And I just made it through sheer tenacity. Surrender is not in my creed. And I persevered and remembered my dead brothers. To me, it would have been dishonor for them if I had killed myself. So I had to press on, moving through each moment, not day, each moment. And here I am.
We're talking to Sergeant Andrew Brandy. He's a Vietnam War veteran, and he's a combat trauma consultant with the Department of Defense. And we will get back to your work, your consulting work now. Let's talk to Ellen Fox. She is the convener of the Santa Fe Soldiers Project. You work with post-traumatic veterans.
I've worked for years with PTSD. It's somewhat new for me to begin working with combat veterans, but there are parallels and there are differences. So in terms of what Sergeant Brandy is saying, I'd first like to say that, without being cavalier, the good news is that we know the brain has plasticity and it can change. So what Sergeant Brandy is talking about is the way the nervous system has to be rewired to be in combat. And all the things you described are necessary. The problem is reintegration. What happens when you come back? And we also know that the VA is overwhelmed. It isn't able to serve the many hundreds of thousands of veterans that need intensive trauma treatment. So I decided that in Santa Fe, at least, to ask for volunteer therapists who would take a veteran, one person at a time, pro bono, and do trauma treatment until it was resolved. And in fact, there is a national project now called the Soldiers Project. It's happening in 6 cities, and we may link up with them, where therapists are volunteering to serve veterans. And it's quite a successful project. But what I want to say is, we know enough now in terms of neuroscience to know that we can offer someone who's suffering from combat fatigue a way to not only reintegrate into society, but to reintegrate their brains, literally. And that takes, I want to say, a couple of the steps that I think are really important. First of all, we have to be able to establish a relationship of trust with someone coming into us who's been in the military. And that can take time because, as Sergeant Brandy said, they may not feel that we're equipped. And I'll tell you a really brief story. How I met him was, I was treating someone in the National Guard for combat trauma and other related issues. And one day he came in and he said, "This guy came to talk to us and he knew exactly what we were feeling," and, you know, on and on. I said, "Well, who was it?" And he said, "It was Sergeant Andrew Brandy." And I said, "Oh my God, I've been looking for him for a year," because I had heard him on the radio talking about this kind of transition that needs help to happen. And that's how we got hooked up. So first of all, it's got to be a relationship of trust. Then what can happen in terms of the modalities we have is we can literally help people to process and digest the trauma they've experienced. That doesn't mean they're going to forget their experience, but it means that the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder can disappear. The flashbacks, the nightmares, the hypervigilance, which is necessary when you're in life-threatening danger every day, all of those can be mitigated. The other thing that we can help with is helping people tolerate the grief, the loss, the dissolution of that worry about bond that you're talking about, which can be supplemented by our mentor program of the Purple Hearts. But we can actually help people reprogram their nervous system so they can reintegrate into society. They can be parents again. They can be spouses again. Because, you know, as you indicated, if that doesn't happen. And the other thing is that when people are willing, the moral and spiritual dilemmas they are in the midst of can be opened up and talked about. So on the plus side, I really feel strongly that we can offer a context for a lot of healing.
How do you do the work of rewiring the brain?
Well, there are two modalities that our group of therapists kind of privilege, and those are EMDR and brain spotting, and they're related. I'll try to make this kind of clear, simple way of describing it. Your brain is an information processing system. It has to be. You have to process all the information that's coming in all the time. What happens with trauma is the experience kind of gets locked in your memory and repeats and repeats and repeats, unless it's, we use the word metabolized, you can use the word digested. These therapies tap hemispheric integration left, right. We're not sure exactly how they work, but we know that if we can recruit the information processing system in the brain and target traumatic memories, they will be processed to resolution. I'll give you an example. This is a general example, not a real case. You know, many, many times soldiers have seen their buddies die in their arms. And they may come to therapy and with survivor's guilt and say, why me? Why didn't I die? You know, he had a family. He had children. So when we're doing either brain spotting or EMDR, we're looking for a way for that narrative to change. And over the course of treatment, what can happen is the person can say, you know, and with coaching, of course, can say, okay, I did survive. What is the mission that my buddy would have wanted me to carry out? How can I pay it forward? You know, what would he want me to be doing in the world? And so that's one example of how someone's story can really change.
What are some, when you've seen that, what kind of things do people then end up doing, carrying forward what might have been their buddy's mission?
Well, we have the Iraq Veterans Against the War. We have people wanting to work with other veterans, which is happening with Rick's program. I'm not sure exactly all of the ramifications of that, but even in terms of families and raising their children, there can be a whole other dimension. It's like Andrew said, when you have killed somebody, that is a basic change in your spiritual experience. And once it's integrated, I think that really informs the way you relate to other humans, to your children, to your wives.
Ellen Fox is a psychotherapist, and Rick Iannucci is the director of the Horses for Heroes program. You are also working with veterans who have post-traumatic stress using horses.
Exactly. We call it combat trauma now. PTSD just didn't seem to. It sounded like something you caught on a doorknob of a hotel somewhere. So we're calling it what it is, and it is trauma, as Ellen pointed out and Andrew pointed out. We've been working with the veterans, and exactly as Ellen said, what we're doing is we're essentially giving them the basic skills to work with four-legged creatures, non-threatening four-legged creatures, after they've been working with two-legged creatures. And our program is of course, called Cowboy Up, and it's characterized by the camaraderie, the confidence, and the compassion that these veterans are experiencing, and our instructors, which are most of our instructors are cowboys, working cowboys that were veterans. And that warrior trust bond that Andy spoke about is something that we're reinforcing, because we have the right people there. We're not just clinicians, we're cowboys, and many of us are veterans as well too. So we bring that, and we bring real-world skills and experiences to the table. We also challenge them to bring their own experience to the table. And as Ellen said, they can get rewired with what we're doing. There's many, many parallels with the cowboy culture and ranch life that they can pick up on.
Parallels between military culture and cowboy culture?
Parallels between the skill sets that they have, the integrity, the loyalty, the honesty, all the cowboy codes that you hear about in this day and age that James Owen's book was writing about, and cowboy ethics and things like that. So we have those parallels. We're offering them that. They're floundering out in the civilian world, many of them. can't get a job, as Andrew said, in Jiffy Lube, and they're like, where do I go? What do I do? Who am I?
With all great respect to the fine men and women working at Jiffy Lube.
Right, exactly. They've got a full staff and a full complement there. But what we're doing is we're in the process of reintegrating, and part of what we do is recreation. It's recreating, the root word from the Latin, recreating their lives and getting them back and assimilating and matriculating back into society in a lot of different ways. What makes our program different than several other, there's a couple other programs in the state that are working or starting up working with veterans too, but they're arena riding and they have certainly a function and purpose, but our purpose working with the OIF, the OEF guys, that's the Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom, men and women veterans that are coming back, and our program is specifically Cowboy Up. It takes it to the next level. We get them through the basic horsemanship skills. They start bonding with the horses, non-threatening. They work. They get off the horse. I've got cowboy veterans there that are Military Order of the Purple Heart, which is our sister organization. We're partnered with them. That's our intake unit. They administratively bring them in. Now, they don't have to be wounded, but anybody that's been over there has combat trauma in some way, shape, or form, or may not, but they're welcome into the programs. We even have some active military people that are getting ready to deploy again that we've been working with. But anyway, combined with the Warrior Mentor Program, we take them in. They get off a horse at our place, at our ranches in South Santa Fe County, the Crossed Arrows Ranch, and they're surrounded by cowboys that are veterans. And symbolically, we're all wearing the purple wild rags, and there's cowboys all over the place. You can see on our blogspot, horsesforheroes.blogspot.com or horsesforheroes.org. People can see the pictures, like Veterans Day. We did a Veterans Day clinic out there with inpatient veterans from and active duty people, actually, too, that were inpatient with the PTSD program from the VA hospital. So we do have an affiliation with those folks down there. Dr. Brian Pilgrim, we've been working with a lot lately, former Marine, now a clinician, now a doctor down there at the VA hospital doing some great work down there with his program. So we bring them up. We get them in a whole different atmosphere. And now, as Ellen was talking about, you have a new mission. Once you get through phase one of our program, we don't kick you out like some other programs say, okay, thank you, you had a good time, 10 lessons, we'll see you later. What we do in our program is that's just the start for you if you want to stay. Now it's your turn to pay it back. We also run the Turquoise Trail Wranglers 4-H Club. So I've got kids out there. I've got over two dozen kids on horseback that are at different levels of horsemanship in the 4-H system. And what we do with them is we'll have our senior kids now starting to work with the veterans, and this will be new for this year. And then what our intent is to get the veterans to the point where they can turn around now and I can bring them on as 4-H leaders. They can either work with the kids. They have a new mission, and it's help their brothers that are getting on these horses, help train the horses. We've got 2,000 acres that we're going to use out in Santa Fe County now where we're going to actually bring our own horses in, and the veterans are going to work under our mentorship, of course, and train the horses that are going to be used for the program. So it's a fully integrated, sideways, upside down program together.
What happens to as we were talking about, the anger, the violence, the adrenaline rush, that kind of crazy energy that Sergeant Brandy was just talking about a moment ago, when they come to you and start riding horses and riding with horses?
That's a very good question. One of the things that we see is, I'll give you a story. We had a young man that came up for our Veterans Day Cowboy Clinic, and Native American, American Indian fella. As I understand the story, he was part of a convoy, a young Marine, part of a convoy that got ambushed. And as I understand it, everyone in his unit had gotten wiped out. He woke up, I guess, sometime later in Walter Reed, like, where am I? What's happening? He's still on active duty. He comes out to Albuquerque. They put him into the clinic, and he ends up coming out to our place. And as the others tell me, he hadn't spoken to anybody in weeks and just really was very withdrawn.
I guess with the word they used to use is shell-shocked.
Shell-shocked, experiencing, as we say now, combat trauma and traumatized. And anyway, we worked with him, and when we get him there, we take him through all the stages. It's a very calm, They start working with the animals, and as soon as you get out there with the horses, many of us remember from the old days, from being kids and growing up, maybe getting a chance to go around horses. But out at the ranch, the atmosphere is, out at our Crossed Arrows Ranch, the atmosphere is very calm. But it's very supportive. There's people around. The atmosphere is good. It feels like family. And when they get out there, I think, to use Andy's word, the vibe is very mellow. And you get out there, you start working with the horse, and we start them bonding with the horses. And they start working from the ground up. From day one, they're automatically with a horse. We pair them up with a horse, and they start working with the animal. And it almost puts you in a trance as you start grooming the horse. And so that anger, and it demands your attention, because not only do we tell them that in the safety briefing, you know, because you can get hurt. This is a 1,200-pound animal that's, you know, taller than you, bigger than you, stronger than you. It demands your full attention. It demands your conscious effort to be with and bond with that horse at many different levels. And as we move through the tasks and the grooming and everything, and we build on that, they eventually go to the riding part where we've got them on horseback. And then we keep building. So they do the same routine every time. So you start to see them going through basically a metamorphosis of calmness, of confidence, of compassion. They start working with each other. They start working with the instructors. The instructors are, we've got the best in the world. We've got a young woman named Christina Savitsky, who is was formerly with Santa Fe Equistar. She brought this program to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, in 2007, and contacted me, and she and I got together with that level 5 NARA instructor. So we've got our instructors that are very skilled, extremely skilled horsemen. They work with the veterans and show them what they're capable and what is possible, not what's probable, but what is possible and what they can do.
You know, as I'm listening, I'm getting very excited, because the key here is integration and reintegration. And Andrew and I have been just starting to talk about how we can pull all of these services together, because what's happening in the Horses for Heroes program is your guys are learning how to soothe and self-soothe in the context of relationships with people, you know, who have had their experience. You integrate that with counseling that's designed to release traumatic experience and learn to tolerate painful feelings, you know, and then you connect that with, say, a mentor program where you can continue the warrior bond. And you really have a healing context, you know, when we can work together like this.
We're talking to U.S. Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Brandy, psychotherapist Ellen Fox, and Rick Iannucci, Director of Horses for Heroes. In January, we had Karen Herman on the air, who runs the Horse Sanctuary and also works with sexual assault services, another type of post-traumatic stress disorder that maybe is less visible. It's women who often are underground about it, but in any case, one of the things that she was saying that I found fascinating was that in the cultures on this planet that are the least violent, where there's the least murder and assault and all those, and rape and all those kinds of things, what you find consistently is that those people in that culture have a close relationship with other species and with the changing cycles of nature.
Absolutely. One of the things, Tufts University just completed a study, and of course we're 4-H leaders as well, and what Tufts found is that the kids that were involved in 4-H, and they studied kids all over the country, they were able to integrate, and they were much more well-balanced, they were better students, and I can't remember the exact figures, but to a kid that they spoke with, that they interviewed, that they worked with, that in their study, the numbers were far superior to the kids that were growing up in the city, just because of the fact that they had been ranch kids, working with animals, working with livestock, working on 4-H programs that demanded their attention, that made them matriculate into that kind of society, ranching and things of that nature. So she's absolutely correct.
Well, I think I can give you a little story here. But before I do, I wanted to say that what Ellen and Rick are talking about is critical to developing a touch with humanity again. Like Rick said, most of the problems that all these young people have been with two-legged animals, human beings. There was a story that a couple of troops told me not too long ago, came back from Iraq. They were telling me about they had to go on rabid dog killing duty. The dogs had rabies. They had to go out and shoot dogs. So they got in their Humvee, went out, and they found a couple dogs that were, you know, obviously had rabies and had to be shot. Well, they got out. They shot them with their M4s. That's their rifle. And they buried them. Said a little prayer over their grave. Now, I'm standing here 1 foot away from these troops, like breath-smelling to breath-smelling distance, and I'm watching their eyes. They felt deep compassion for the dogs. Well, they said about an hour and a half later, they were in their Humvee again. They got in a firefight. They killed two of the enemy, maybe not the enemy, two Hajis. They drug them up by the road, shot them a few more times, and left them lie there on the ground to bloat in 125 degrees. While they're telling me this story, although that may sound gruesome to some, this is just war. But when they were telling me the story, I was watching their eyes. They went from a feeling of compassion and concern over those dogs, turned that into rage, anger, and satisfaction over killing human beings. They thought of those human beings as less than scum, maggots on the earth. And they were happy to kill them, couldn't wait to kill some more. So the point I'm making is, the way to get them back in touch with their own humanity is to put them in a program where they can touch another life form, like you were talking about. Another life form, a horse. The icon of America, power, strength, nobility. And make friends with that. And that develops their self-esteem. And then they go from touching the horse to shaking hands with another veteran in that combat trust bond, and then they can move into other areas like Ellen was talking about, reintegration. You see, so this whole thing is a composite of emotions and feelings. And I keep telling the people in Washington, you've got to think of warriors as living through emotion, feelings, moment to moment, not intellect. We respond first by training, reaction, and then the thinking process comes into play.
Now, you are a combat trauma consultant with the Department of Defense, and you were at Fort Hood the day before.
Oh, I was in North Fork, Virginia,
okay.
The day before Fort Hood happened.
Right, and basically saying things like this are going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And when the next day I got five calls from Washington. By the way, I work in alliance with the DOD. I don't get a paycheck.
Right.
They just use my...
Andy's also on staff. He's our trauma consultant.
Right.
And he's usually when we bring our guys in or our women in, Andy's one of their first stops. And
yeah.
He checks their oil, so to speak, and helps them matriculate into our program as well.
Yeah,
he's, not only is he's also a neighbor, so...
Yeah, we're looking for triggers, things that might affect them when we're doing the training program for the other cowboys and cowgirls. Well, yeah, I was in Norfolk, Virginia, and told the brass. I mean, we're talking about admirals, generals, the whole nine yards, what was going on, and warning them about the danger to civilians, to our society. And I was kidding with you earlier. It was like the little bobbleheads, you know, that up and down sideways. And then the next morning or the next day.
I mean, they said, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, we'll have to look into that. You know, kind of the blow off the,
right, right.
The crazy Marine. And then I got five calls from Washington the next day because they were saying, oh, my God, it was like you were predicting the future. And I said, no, I'm telling you the present. The Army, this is not the RAND study. I don't want to go into that, but the Army is telling me they're expecting 800,000 to 1 million troops coming back after these conflicts with severe combat trauma, PTSD, whatever you want to call it. And what's in place to help them? And I tell these guys in Washington, guys and gals, all right, how many Army Rangers do we have? I was a Force Recon Marine. Rick was a Green Beret. That's a special operations units in the military, very elite, very well-trained soldiers, trained in city siege, trained in destabilization of the enemy, winning by attrition, and we've got about 100,000 Rangers. How many thousands of Marines out there trained to do this? really angry, looking for payback, and looking for an excuse to make someone else the enemy besides the ones they're fighting now. And I think that's a real threat. Now, the way to circumvent that is to address the issues like Ellen and Rick are talking about and start to work with them and treat them like they're okay, they're normal, and that, hey, just trust me a little bit for a little while. I'll prove to you, because trust is earned, that I can help you if you want to be helped. And here's the danger. A lot of the troops are so far gone, they don't know they have a problem, and they don't want to be helped. They want nothing to do with the VA or anything in the government, and they're very resentful. They have to blame someone for the losses of the friends that they went through. So there you go. See, we have it's a catch-22.
Well, and as we were talking about before, I mean, I know somebody who came back from Iraq, a veteran, who really resented being called a hero and really resented it when people thanked him for his service there. He hated it. He said the whole thing is wrong and misguided, and I shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Right. Well, I never make political statements, and I can't explain why we're there or whatever else politically, but the fact is we are there. And that's exactly what I hear from the troops. They don't really care why they're there. They just want to go back and be with their brothers and sisters. They're angry that they have to do that, that they've lost their friends. There doesn't seem to be any justification for a lot of them. But they've got the baggage now, which clinicians like Ellen and Rick here are going to have to deal with and deprogram. You know, sort of like the Manchurian candidate, but deprogram, de-boot camp.
Well, what's exciting is that there's a real grassroots parallel process happening in terms of offering treatment, because we know that the government is not providing what it should, which in my mind is therapy for every single returning soldier who would want it and who would not be afraid to ask for it because it wouldn't affect their record. So we have a grassroots parallel process. And you were just telling me that in Colorado Springs, you have a colleague who's having how many? 700? Has treated 700?
Right. A private practice set up. It's called the Warrior Outreach Center. And they have now 700 clients. They don't call them patients anymore.
Clients.
But let me tell you why the troops won't come forward.
Yeah.
You know, there's a... In a military unit, you develop a trust bond between each other. It's a family unit, a sacred family unit. Now, we're a tribe mentality, human beings, gregarious species. What's the worst thing that can happen to you as a member of the tribe? You're outcast. So what
getting
happens?
Getting shunned like the Amish.
Getting shunned, right. So if you're turned away from your class, you're shamed. And that's dishonor.
Now, if you ask for help,
you can't do that. Mm. They cannot ask for help, because if they do, they show weakness. Mm-hmm. If you're in a fire team and your brothers are there and they're covering your back and you're watching them, if they think you're weak, if they think you're going to hesitate from pulling that trigger, they don't want you on their team. So you're out. And when you're out, you've lost everything. You've
the other
lost
thing
your
too,
honor.
I talked to one of my friends who's one of my good friends, a guy I served with. He's a combat search and rescue helicopter pilot, and he's flown more combat missions or combat rescue missions than probably anybody in the system right now. He said, I don't dare go up there. I'm a light colonel. I do not dare go up there and tell them that I need help. You know what happens to me? I'm off the colonel list. I'm out of the unit.
And grounded.
I'm in the rubber gun squad and grounded until they think, and maybe they'll never think that I'm back again. So that's the catch-22 there.
See, so what's happening, Mary, is they've been through more combat than anybody in history. They've got more stress than anybody in history, and they are not allowed to admit their own humanity.
Right.
They can't even admit that they feel anything for killing. They can't feel anything for the loss. And they're made to suck it up and keep it in.
How do you, having been through all that you've been through, mm-hmm. how do you talk to them and maybe show them that it is okay to ask for help once all this is over?
Well, I do. How do I do it?
Yeah.
Well, I get up and I use a lot of profanity, a lot of good examples, a lot of things that would make you want to puke stories, and let them know that they're okay. It's normal. It's normal to feel some remorse when you kill a child. It's okay. It doesn't make you weak to cry. It doesn't make you weak to ask for some counseling.
And coming from you, they'll hear
it. Yeah, they hear it.
They hear
it. I keep telling them, look, you're going to be better fighters. They call it war fighting in the clinician world. You're going to be better combat troops if you know what's coming. If you know when you kill a kid, you're going to feel really bad. If you know when you watch your friend split in half by an IED, you're going to feel really bad. This is human behavior. It's our reaction as human beings. But they're denied that. They're denied the right to come forward. And they're charged with sucking it up, bucking up.
See, one of the things, our program, we're open to active military as well. And I fund this out of my pension. We're a nonprofit.
We're all volunteers.
I have a great staff of volunteers, so they don't have to go to the VA. They don't have to go in through the system, so to speak. They can come in through the Purple Heart. They could come in right directly through Andy. They can come right up to us, yeah, and on a phone call.
Well, let me defend the VA, please, here. I think it's important to do this, like Jiffy Lube, like you said, Nick. The VA is doing everything they can.
Yes, they
are. The reason why they don't want to go to the VA is not because they're not doing a good job. It's because they don't want any mention of any kind of combat trauma in their records.
Right.
If they have anything like that, they can't get a job anywhere. They can't become a policeman, a fireman. They can't do anything with responsibility. So they're forced, again, in civilian society. See, in the military, they're forced not to admit anything. They come out in civilian society. Again, they're forced not to admit anything. They're caught in a vice.
Ellen Fox, I think one of the encouraging things about this work is that the brain actually can change. Healing really can happen on a neural level as well as an emotional level, or maybe the two things are ultimately the same thing.
That's correct. And there are a couple of messages I want to make sure our audience gets. We're calling this the Soldiers Project Santa Fe right now, and it's going to be for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. We can't see anyone else at the moment. We hope to expand. And as you said, Mary Charlotte, this is what's important. The brain has neuroplasticity. It can and does change over the lifetime. So whatever brain or nervous system you went into warfare with has been profoundly altered. And it has to be altered in order for you to perform. But in order to transition back to civilian life, it needs to change again. So here's what we are going to offer. Our team uses therapies that are designed to jumpstart the brain into its processing or digestion ability so that what is stuck can be brought to resolution. And these therapies are somatic experiencing, EMDR, and brain spotting. These therapies work when the client feels safe enough and trusts the therapist. So they're not, quote, magic bullets, no pun intended, but they're very, very effective for helping the brain to make the adjustments and healing it needs to make. And so as one client said to me, and I love this, after he finished therapy, he said, now it's like walking through a minefield, but the mines don't go off anymore.
Mm. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and it was a beautiful metaphor. And that's what we hope to achieve in our offering of treatment to people who are suffering from combat trauma. And that's what I want to make sure everybody understands in terms of our project.
And Ellen, there's a couple of websites that I know you wanted to give people.
Right. So for EMDR description, emdria.org,
okay,
has a wonderful description of what EMDR is. You can Google brain spotting and you'll get a very good description of what that is. For somatic experiencing, you can look up Wikipedia and it will explain it. And for, in general, if you want more information, the soldiersproject.org is a national project like ours. We may link with that one. And for women veterans, there's graceafterfire.org, which is also a very helpful website.
We've just got a minute or two left. Part of the reason that we are focusing so much attention on this is, first of all, to ask therapists to join Ellen Fox and the others in offering services to these veterans if they would like to do so, and just to know that these services like Ellen's services and Horses for Heroes are available because they're not being publicized through government programs.
Correct.
So I would like to give a phone number. People can call me at 505-699-4312. And now we're just getting established. We have about 20 volunteers. And so if somebody is willing, ready to ask for some help, and this is not just for individuals, this is for families or couples.
I want to say also, for any veterans or families listening, you can go to my website, sergeantbrandy.com. We have hotlines there for the Military Order of the Purple Heart, linked up with Ellen and Rick's Cowboy Up program, and get some help right away.
And you can also go to warriorsguidetoinsanity.com. And for Rick's program, you can go to horsesforheroes.org. And what's the phone number
over there? The phone number there is, and we have a live person there. It's 505-798-2535.
And you'll link up with just sergeantbrandy.com, that website. You can link to that one, but go directly to sergeantbrandy.com.
And the Military Order of the Purple Heart, New Mexico, has our link as well, and we have their link.
We're all linked up.
So they can get help, and we will. They can patch us through to, even if we're out on the ranch, we can get a call in at our office alternatives down in Albuquerque. He's providing the link for us. They'll connect us even if we're on horseback.
Sergeant Andrew Brandy is a United States Marine Corps Vietnam veteran. He's author of the book The Warrior's Guide to Insanity. He's a combat trauma consultant with the Department of Defense. Psychotherapist Ellen Fox is the convener of the Santa Fe Soldiers Project. And Rick Iannucci is the director of Horses for Heroes. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. My email is RadioCafe@KSFR.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.